You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Jonathan Holland. I work with the Nepal and Bhutan Initiative, which might be an odd choice to introduce our guest today, the Zimbabwean writer Peter Godwin. But I've had the fortune of studying under Peter briefly at Columbia University, and my family's from Zimbabwe as well, so I'm somewhat partial to the books. Peter Godwin is an award-winning foreign correspondent, author, documentary maker, and screenwriter. Raised in Rhodesia at age 18, Peter was drafted into the Rhodesian Army, I think that's accurate, to fight in a civil war he grew to detest, an experience chronicled in Mukiwa, his first in a series of three memoirs about Zimbabwe. After university in the UK, Peter returned to a newly independent Zimbabwe, flushed with optimism, to work as a foreign correspondent. In 1983, Peter broke the story of the Matabele massacres, in which 20,000 southern Zimbabweans were estimated to be killed by President Mugabe's North Korean-trained 5th Brigade. The massacre shed light on a face of Robert Mugabe, which at that time, you know, he was very widely admired in the international community, including by my own Zimbabwean parents. Since that time, Peter has revisited Mugabe's Zimbabwe through numerous articles and books, including When a Crocodile Swallows the Sun, which chronicles Zimbabwe's by now familiar fall from grace in the 1990s. Peter Godwin's latest book, published earlier this year in the U.S., is The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe, in which Peter set out in 2009 to, quote-unquote, dance on Mugabe's political grave after the promise of new elections, but ended up bearing witness to a country turned upside down and inside out by an election that was anything but free and fair. I think Peter will discuss the book, possibly read from it for about half an hour, 40 minutes or so, or whatever the course takes us. But we'd like to really open up the floor for questions and really promote some discussion. So I hope everybody will contribute. Thank you.
Thanks. Excuse me. Can you hear me? Is that, yeah? So Jonathan's right. I do want to open it up to questions sooner rather than later, because it's always slightly confusing when I'm talking about Zimbabwe to an audience that I don't know, because some people know all sorts of details and other people don't know anything about it, and it's very hard for me to judge just sitting here. So I'd quite like to take my cue from you, and I can answer at great loquacious length, as you'll see. So I'm going to keep my introductory remarks relatively short, and then do the rest of it off your questions, if you'll permit me that. This book, The Fear, is to some extent an accidental book. In many ways, I mean, I'm an Anglo-African, and the Anglo part of it is we're supposed to feel self-deprecating and embarrassed about personal details, and to have written not one, not two, but three memoirs seems a little excessive. This third one I certainly didn't intend to do, but the first memoir I wrote, Mukiwa, which Jonathan's alluded to, was really a coming-of-age memoir. It was about growing up in Zimbabwe. And in the way that all children think that the life they are leading as a child is normal because it's the only life they know, it's often only in retrospect when you look back at a childhood and realize that it was actually deeply abnormal. And in my case, very strange. I mean, I was born into an almost Victorian African situation, the dog days of colonialism, then lived through the kind of, you know, Zimbabwe's Vietnam, lived through a civil war and insurgency and that, and then Zimbabwe caught up with the rest of Africa, and when Robert Mugabe came. And so there were these three distinct cycles of history. And so Mukiwa was about that, and it really was, when I'm teaching writing, I always try and make a distinction between autobiography and memoir, and I very firmly fall on the memoir side. I mean, the distinction, which might seem a little precious, but I think is important, was usually you'll read an autobiography about someone who is already famous for doing something or being someone, a president or a sporting star or an actor or whatever, and in those cases you really are interested in perhaps, you know, their diet or their exercise regime or something. In a memoir, you're really, it's about a time and a place, but told very personally. And in this particular one, I mean, I worked for the BBC for many years, and to use a televisual analogy, in an autobiography, you're standing in front of the camera and you're doing your stand-up and you're trying to kind of be in full screen all the time. Whereas in a memoir, the camera's on your shoulder. And so you're pointing it and it's highly personal and indeed subjective, but you're not trying to be in front of it all the time, but you're speaking into it and giving the audio the guide track and whatever. And it's just a change. It's a difference in perspective. But be that... So that was Makiwa. Then, and I thought I was done with that. And in Makiwa, one of the reasons we had a life, an upbringing, as it were, that was unusual even by then Rhodesian, now Zimbabwean standards, is that my parents weren't really normal people. They were pretty eccentric. My mother was a doctor and worked in a very remote area on the Mozambique border, And I used to go around with her on her rounds in those areas, and the book was very much, you know, that certainly the first bit of that book was very much about that. But as some readers noted, my father seemed a kind of slightly remote figure in that, and indeed, I mean, insofar as he was described, he was this colonial Brit in a safari suit and desert boots, striding around the bush with a great walrus moustache and a kind of force field around him that you couldn't penetrate at all. You could barely talk to him. He was very gruff and distant, a sort of Victorian paterfamilias, not at all touchy-feely. And if I said to him any one of the things that my own sons say to me on a daily basis, I'm sure I would have been hung up by meat-hook. Anyway, that was him, you know, sort of colonial Brit archetype. And subsequently, that was Makiwa. I carried on. I worked as a foreign correspondent. I covered Africa for many years. I think I covered every single war in Africa over a 10-year period. And I covered the last 5 years of apartheid, which was the sort of, you know, I think looking back on it, still the big story of my generation, certainly as a foreign correspondent and obviously as an African. And as my father sickened eventually and thought he was going to die, I was actually by then working for various other... I was freelancing, working for National Geographic and New York Times magazine, and I was down in South Africa doing a story in Zululand. And my father had a heart attack, and my mother got hold of me, and I rushed back up to Zimbabwe because we thought he was going to die. And in fact, he recovered. By this stage, Zimbabwe was just starting to turn. The economy was just starting to kind of, you know, go into what we later discovered was this kind of extraordinary nosedive. And my father, in fact, recovered from this particular, from this episode. And as I was getting ready to go back to come back to New York, where I lived by then, he put up a photograph on the wall of three people I'd never seen before, and it turned out that they were his parents and his sister, and that far from being the sort of pucker colonial Brit, my father was actually a Polish Jew, and his family had been killed in the Holocaust. So that brought on When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, which was really a dual story in which his background and his story, his backstory, is woven together with the... With the collapse of Zimbabwe, and indeed, as it turns out, the collapse of my father. I mean, he ails through the course of the book and dies twice, in fact, at the beginning and the end of the book, and the sort of device that I've used there at the beginning and the end of the book is the same. I guess it's about, you know, 1,200 word description of cremating my father, which was the one thing that he'd asked me to do. He'd never asked me for anything at all, and he just asked me pretty much on his deathbed if I could make sure that he was cremated because he didn't want to be buried. And it was so difficult by then logistically trying to organize the funeral. There was no fuel and there was no electricity half the time, one thing out, that I kind of left the cremation till the last minute. And when I phoned up the crematorium, they said, the one crematorium in Harare, they said, they didn't have any butane gas left at all, and there was no way I could do it anywhere else. And so in the end, I went to the Zimbabwe Hindu Society, and they said that they couldn't allow me to cremate, to put him on a funeral pyre, because he wasn't a Hindu. And so I begged and wheedled and cajoled, and eventually we came to a compromise where if we converted him post mortem to become a Hindu, that I could burn him on one of their pyres. So, and in the book I make the point that it seemed rather fitting that my father, who was born a Jew, then converted to Church of England, to Protestantism, and then post mortem becomes a Hindu. He was covering most of his bases. We missed Buddhism, but I think they'd be forgiving about that. And indeed, that's what I did. We built a pyre and carried my father's body onto the top in a winding sheet. And let me tell you that a DIY cremation is very different to taking it to a commercial facility. For one thing, you don't just get a little coffee jar or whatever, an urn full of sort of grey talcum powder at the end. It's very different. The human femur is a very enduring bone. so that was Crocodile. And Crocodile also, I mean, as I said, there were these two stories, but it was also very much about the collapse of Zimbabwe, and it was about the land issue and all sorts of other things, and about really the growing dictatorship and the attempts of this new opposition to unseat Mugabe. And I thought that was probably that, as far as that type, that genre of writing about Zimbabwe goes for me. That was that. And then, excuse me, in 2008, there were elections in Zimbabwe, and various little concessions had been squeezed out of Mugabe. Mugabe's a very interesting person. I sometimes worry that I might be suffering from some kind of political Stockholm syndrome, in the sense that he's a lot more interesting than a lot of other common or garden dictators. He's not just this. He isn't sort of, you know, an Idi Amin character, the heavyweight boxing champion of the King's African Rifles, who's just sort of, you know, bludgeons his way into power and bludgeons his way to stay there, and then is eventually sort of, you know, it's all about the violence and the bullying and whatever. Mugabe's a much more complicated person, and indeed a much more intellectual person, and somebody who you have to admit has played the hand that he's been given rather skillfully in directly political terms. He's a master manipulator, and that's not just of his own people. He's to see him operate on the international stage, and in particular on the regional and African stage, is to see someone consistently run rings around, you know, around Pan-African leadership, around SADC leadership, and indeed, I'm afraid to say, around South African leadership. He's very much, he's not just reactive. He really does strategize, and he's a master tactician. And one of the things that's very dear to his heart, and it sounds odd saying this in 2011, but is a kind of moral platform. When Mugabe looks in the mirror, he doesn't see what most of the rest of the world now sees, which is a sort of increasingly blood-tinged authoritarian dictator. He still sees the liberation leader that he once was. And so it's important to him to have these little Democrats. You know, he wants to be thought of as a Democrat, and certainly among his own supporters he still is. And so there were various concessions in the 2008 elections, and I still didn't think that he would let it slip from his grip. But for various reasons, which I can go into later if there's interest in it, but for various reasons, as those elections took place, it suddenly looked like he'd misjudged and that he was actually going to lose to the opposition, to the Movement for Democratic Change, and there was this giddy period. I mean, in retrospect, it lasted all of 10 days. But the thing about history is, and the thing that annoys me about the way history is written is that it often seems to assume that once something has happened, it was always inevitable that thing would happen. And that's not how life works, and it's not how history actually, you know, plays out in real time, when you sit there and you don't know how it's going to change, how it's going to turn out, and if some one little decision had gone the other way, things might have been entirely different. And for that 10 days, it really did look like he was prepared to stand down. And it was in that moment that I was asked by a magazine here, I was assigned by Vanity Fair to go and do this story on what looked like the end of whatever it was, you know, nearly 30 years of one man's rule. And Mugabe had become completely synonymous with Africa. Let me just draw back 1 second. I'm not going to be too much longer, don't worry. To say that, you know, in another way, I feel odd in that I've written 3 books, in fact, more than 3 books now, about what is on the face of it, one small little country in Africa. You know, I mean, why would one keep going back and writing about one small country in a continent of many much bigger, more important, more populous, and wealthier countries? But the reason for it, the reason I'm drawn to it, quite apart from the fact that I have an expertise and a history and a kind of some sort of a cultural, some kind of cultural insight, I hope, into it, is that Zimbabwe is and always has been greater than the sum of its parts. For various reasons, it has played the role of a sort of African barometer. It was seen initially, if you think about it, as almost the last holdout. In fact, it sort of was the last colonial holdout, if you like. I mean, Namibia didn't really count. And in that sense, and only insofar as it had been stolen by the South Africans. I don't mean it doesn't count at all. Of course it counts. I love Namibia. Some of my best friends are Namibian. And in that sense, the civil war in Zimbabwe was a kind of fascinating thing to observe. It wasn't quite so fascinating to be in it at the time, I can assure you. But what it was also in many ways a kind of foretaste of what was to happen in South Africa, actually shockingly quickly, if one thinks of it again in historical terms. You know, the Zimbabwe becomes independent in 1980, and South Africa follows barely 13 years later, which is a blink of an eye in historical terms. It then becomes this kind of great beacon on the hill, on the African hill, Zimbabwe does, of what can be achieved in Africa. It has these extraordinary these extraordinary achievements. It soon has the highest literacy rate in Africa. I mean, you see different figures, 93%, 95%, whatever, but a very, very high literacy rate, which Mugabe had invested in education. It had an amazing health system. It had an amazing infrastructure, most of which it inherited, but it built on. It also had this bizarrely successful commercial agricultural system. I use the word bizarre only insofar as, you know, I was in Zimbabwe in 1979, and Mugabe wasn't expected to win the election. Again, here's something you forget in that sort of, in the kind of anesthetizing historical dead hand that makes it look like Mugabe was always going to win the election. No, he wasn't. And lots of people, including the Brits and the South Africans and all sorts of intelligence agencies, were saying right up until the last minute that this wasn't going to happen. And indeed it did. And it happened quite easily. He won, I think, 57% overall, which was you know, easily enough to win without any coalition. But at the time, bear in mind that Mugabe had been demonized not just by white Rhodesians, but by many in the Western press. He was a Marxist. He was going to nationalize everything. He was going to launch a sort of racial vendetta, you know, in revenge for what had been done for you know, more than 100 years of white rule, and he did none of these things. In fact, what was extraordinary was that, I mean, he was in many ways the sort of prototype Mandela figure, in that he embraced racial reconciliation. He didn't nationalize industries by and large. But most extraordinary, given that the war was, I was always told that the war, if it was firstly about one man, one vote, in very near second place was the land issue, that a few whites owned disproportionate amounts of land, of agricultural land. And Mugabe pulled everybody together and made this speech quite soon after he came to power. And he addressed it specifically to white Rhodesians, and who were all getting ready to leave, especially the white farmers, who were all getting ready mostly to go down south, to go to South Africa, which was still white ruled, and said to them, don't leave, stay. And if you stay, you know, here's what I guarantee you. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to stay and contribute to the New Zimbabwe and go back to your farms and grow food and grow tobacco for foreign currency, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I want you to do. And that's what happened. So in agriculture, and Zimbabwe at the end is all about agriculture. It's not just the farms themselves, but it's all the ancillary industries that are grouped around farming, that so much of it is really to do with farming. And so and farming, a lot of it there, especially tobacco farming, very labor-intensive. And so that was really the economy. So Zimbabwe became this astonishing country that everybody would quote and go and have a look at and say, you know, and it showed just what could be done in Africa. And it also, you know, the whites, I mean, they were at the height of Zimbabwean of Rhodesian independence. The whites never quite reached 300,000. That was as most, but in the 80s there were probably still, you know, 150,000 something, you know, people had left, but there was still a rump, a decent sized white population, many of them involved in farming. And then basically we scoot forward to the late 90s when an opposition emerges. And this is where it all gets hazy. That the sort of, if this were a Hollywood movie, the kind of the trajectory, the plot trajectory would be and basically is, if you look at kind of good newspapers and things, that essentially you've got the Mugabe plot is good leader turns bad. You have this, you know, this person who rules terrifically for a long period of time, and then suddenly in the late 1990s, combination of age, combination of his first wife Sally, who was Ghanaian, who had died, and who is seen as being the sort of tempering influence on him, and instead he marries, and in fact has already had two children by at this point. His first wife Sally spent the last few years of her life on kidney dialysis. That this young avaricious wife, who's 30 years his junior, and you know she has a different kind of perspective, and he turns into the sort of dictator we all love to hate, that is now, that, you know, internationally has this terrible reputation, blah blah blah. And I wish it were that simple, because it would be much easier to explain and it would make a much better movie. But you know, life is inconvenient. And I think there's a great, I think that the fact that it's not simple is a lesson that we should all pay attention to, because often we want a certain outcome and we ignore signs to the contrary, because we don't want that to be the case. You know, it's I sometimes see it even now, you know, with, and I'm not, this is not a direct analogy, but you know, that we all want the South Africa story to have a happy ending. And when the ANC does things that make, you know, that are perturbing, it's something that one doesn't really want to kind of hear about, because South Africa's a good luck story. It's a story that ended right, didn't it? You know, that's the way it must go. And in Zimbabwe, it was a similar thing. But as Johnson's already alluded to, you know, I was one of those people who went back from the Zimbabwean diaspora. I went back to Zimbabwe. I was at university in England, and I came back in 1980, essentially. I drove overland down Africa, which took me a year. It was an extraordinary experience, and one, I think, which everybody should do once in their life if you want to understand how the continent works as a continent, rather than just sort of flying back and forth over it. And I went back, and there was this big diaspora of all races going back, and we were very enthusiastic, and we were going to show that we could create this post-racial country in Africa, and that if anything it would be this example to South Africa. It would take the fear out of being a one man one vote country in Africa, that whites certainly could survive in that situation. And so I wasn't sort of embittered. My parents weren't farmers. We hadn't lost anything. In fact, if anything, as I described in Makiwa, I mean, the one, you know, there were three of us in my family, three children. I was in the middle, and my older sister Jane had been killed in the war, in the Zimbabwean war, but was actually killed by the Rhodesian side in an accident, in a sort of accidental ambush. Ran into a ran into the army was setting an ambush just at sunset, and they were on the road deploying, and my sister and her fiance and their best man, 10 days before the wedding, they ran into the back of this and were all killed. So if anything, I wasn't embittered, we hadn't lost the farm, blah blah blah, and yet what then happened was that essentially, as a young journalist, I mean, I was a lawyer originally. I had worked as a litigator. That's what I'd done at university. And when I came back to Zimbabwe, I started doing that while I was finishing a PhD. And I ended up being the junior counsel on a high treason case where Mugabe had arrested all the main generals of the other liberation group, one which is barely talked about now, called ZAPU, which was headed by Joshua Nkomo. And they were arrested and charged with high treason. And we had this long court case. It went on for a year, essentially. And I did all the political research, and I interviewed them on an almost daily basis in the maximum security prison, Chikarubi. And we got them off. There was it was a proper case, and there was a proper judge, and it was, it was an extraordinary thing, because it was argued essentially, high treason is a common law crime. It's not a statutory crime. So you're using precedents from the English Civil War and things. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary. It was an extraordinary case, and I was going to Lusaka to interview the KGB station chief, who wanted to be known in court only as Comrade Max, to preserve his. Anyway, and we got them off, but they were then immediately rearrested under, and this is where it starts getting interesting, under the emergency regulations, which were still there courtesy of Ian Smith. That so basically you had all of the, Smith had used regulations, not that he needed to, because he controlled Parliament almost completely. I think there was one opposition MP, but used regulations, and Mugabe has used them too. It's a way to subvert Parliament, and he used these to just get these guys back in prison, and they stayed there for some time to come. Shortly thereafter, he then sent his North Korean trained 5th Brigade into southern Matabele land, actually into northern Matabele land too. And there had been a small dissident problem. I mean, it's a complicated situation, which again I can explain. I'm going to shut up in a minute and let you ask questions. But these guys were sent down there, and they basically attacked civilians. And they had lists of the ZAPU party officials right down to village level, and they would turn up at a village and just read out a list of names, and people would be called, and then they would be taken away and they'd be shot. And we still don't know how many people were killed, because there's never been an inquiry that's been allowed to publish. There's never been any trials. There's never been any accounting at all. What I'm trying to show is, in fact, this by the way happens in 1983-84. If you go back, and then essentially by 85, 86, Mugabe bullies ZAPU into a government of, I was about to say government of national unity, it's a Freudian slip, that's what we've got now, but into the equivalent. I mean, it was called I can't remember what they called it now, I'm blanking on it, but he pulled them in, and they were co-opted and emasculated and essentially never really heard of again. And so from the mid-80s through to the end of the 90s, there isn't overt repression, because what you actually have in reality is a one-party state. So there isn't an opposition. There's nobody that you need to go and beat up or imprison or shoot or threaten or do whatever. It's a one-party state. And that starts to break down at the end of the 90s. And the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, its leaders emerge out of the previously pliant union movement. Morgan Tsvangirai was the head of the union, and the two or three other people at the head of the MDC come from the unions as well. And then what you start seeing again there is overt oppression again, and all sorts of kind of violence and threats of violence and whatever. And if you look back over Mugabe's, what I think it's instructive to do, if you look back over Mugabe's sort of MO, his political modus operandi, it's useful to say, well, let's just go back. Let's suspend morality and indignation and moral outrage and whatever for a second, and just look at this kind of, scientifically, and say, let's go back to the points in his career where Mugabe faces real political challenges and see how he reacts and see if we can detect some sort of a pattern there. So you go back and you say, okay, well, let's go all the way to, let's go right to the beginning, and let's see the struggles, the leadership struggles within variously ZANU, ZAPU, it had different names in those days, and what happens, and how Mugabe gets to the top of that heap. And what you see is extreme violence. You see assassinations, you see terrible things, people, you know, the factions doing absolutely terrible things to each other, throwing themselves in pits, people disappearing, people being blown up, people being poisoned. Now, and for ages, what's easy to do is to blame absolutely everything on the Rhodesian special branch, the Rhodesian dirty tricks. And indeed, some of it was the Rhodesian dirty tricks. But what's funny in a situation like that is where you've got what are called the Rhodesian equivalent to the CIA, I suppose, and the FBI sort of rolled into one. It's called the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization. And when they were blamed for even a whole lot of things that they hadn't done, they were quick to say, yes, that was us, because it made them look even more powerful and efficient than they really were. And so for the longest of time, it was difficult to unravel actually who did what to whom. But as we're now seeing with more and more memoirs and people coming up from senior ZANU people of that time, you realize that actually this wasn't the case. So there's what you have there as an early indication of a violent response to political problem. The war itself may be morally justified, that they're against a, you know, repressive regime that's undemocratic, is nevertheless a violent response to an intractable political problem. The first elections in 1980, what you have there is that all the parties, the Rhodesian security forces and the two guerrilla armies, were supposed to pull back and demilitarize the voting situation so that you could have a free and fair vote with nobody feeling threatened. And the Rhodesians pretty much did, ZAPU pretty much did, but Mugabe left, you know, there are different estimates, but, you know, several thousand of his best guerrillas out in the field, and they fanned out and they said to the people, the voters, the black civilian voters principally, rural ones mostly, they said to them, listen, vote ZANU or Aluta Continua, you know, the war continues. And the truth is, in my view, that they probably would have voted ZANU anyway, certainly in enough numbers for Mugabe to have won. But for the purposes of this exercise, what's interesting is that he wasn't prepared to take that risk, that what you see is somebody interested almost exclusively in power rather than in democracy. Now, you can be interested in democracy if you're convinced it's going to deliver you power, but at a certain point where being democratic sheds, you know, power from you, then that's when you get counted as a democrat, whether you then accept that the will of the people has changed and you walk, you know, you take your stage left exit, or whether you say, well, now I'm not quite so interested in unalloyed democracy, I'm going to fiddle with it. So what you have in that, even in 1980, is what you see is that he's got people in there just making sure that this democratic casino, you know, that it goes towards the house. Matabeleland massacres, you have that again, and then in the late 1990s, 2000, with the farm invasions and the very well recorded attacks on opposition on MDC members, you've got that too. So what you've really got is someone who's quite consistent. Mugabe hasn't suddenly changed. He hasn't had a sudden rush of blood to the head. He's been a very consistent operator, political operator. What's changed, it seems to me, is us. The rest of the world changed. The international system changed. So, for example, in 1980, when Mugabe comes to power, we're in the middle of the Cold War still, and apartheid still persists. But we're 10 years before the Berlin Wall is going to come down. And at that point, all the West is interested in, you know, we use Africa as a proxy battleground to play East against West. And all we're interested, you know, in Washington is, are you on our side or are you on Moscow's side, or sort of, you know, stroke Beijing, you know, which side are you on? And we're quite happy in all of those years to support, you know, dictators like Mobutu in what we call Zaire, now Congo, you know, all of Siad Barre in Somalia. We had no compunction doing that. We weren't. It wasn't a moral game we were playing. We were just playing East against West. So when Mugabe in 1980 pops up and we think, oh, he's going to be on the other side, and suddenly he's sort of kind of capitalist and kind of seems, you know, although he wants to be quote unquote non-aligned, he's not, you know, he's not in the communist camp, then, you know, there's more joy in heaven over whatever, one black sheep coming back or whatever that, I'm not very good on the Bible, but you know what I mean, that he's then, you know, so he then, we are then invested in him, he's sort of, he's okay. The other And so the Mashpee La Masque, what's extraordinary about it, given that, you know, we as best estimates, we think about 20,000 people, we don't know, it could be more, it could be a few, maybe fewer, but around that mark died. If you go back and look at the press at the time, almost no reaction in the media at all, almost none, nothing at the UN, no demarche, nothing goes on. Mugabe doesn't even get so much as really a slap on the wrist. And after the Mashpee La Masque, he gets a knighthood from the Queen. He gets multiple honorary doctorates from, you know, good universities like Edinburgh University. I got involved in a terrible sort of feud with them where it was my first, actually one of my first encounters with social media, and you sort of realize how important it is. So I sent out some dyspeptic thing saying it was, you know, disgusting that he still had this doctorate. I was looking around some and came across the fact that Mugabe still had a doctorate from Edinburgh University, and this was about 3 years ago, whenever it was, and saying this. And so then this big campaign started to say to Edinburgh, this is disgusting, you must take it away, blah, blah, blah. And so they kind of eventually they did, and but as they took it away, they wrote this letter saying, well, we're taking it away now because, you know, he's done terrible things in Zimbabwe sort of post 2000. But how are we to know at the time? You know, we still think that at the time we were right to give it to him. And I said, they gave it to him just after the Mashpee La Masque. And they said, well, you know, who knew about that? Well, for one, the paper that I worked for was running it on the front page. So it wasn't exactly hidden. So there is this kind of hypocrisy. It's not just limited to governments either. Sort of bien passant, people think that, you know, Mugabe was a good thing and therefore, you know, we're trammelled like that. That was the first smokescreen, the Cold War. The other smokescreen for Mugabe, under which he could get away with things, was the persistence of apartheid until 93, whereby there was this weird thing that if you criticised Mugabe, it was very easy for him to make you look like you were an apologist for apartheid. And that's what happened to me when I wrote about the Mashpee La Masque, that in a sense, you know, what one wanted to do, and even again, and even people who were anti-apartheid, they didn't want horror stories coming from Zimbabwe because it served to stiffen the resolve of white South Africa to oppose black rule, because they thought, oh my God, we don't want to have majority rule down here. Look what has happened to the whites in Zimbabwe. And so there was that attitude too. And again, one of the things that is you barely read about in history books, but the inciting incident that freaked out white Rhodesians when Britain was jettisoning its colonies, you know, very quickly, and Rhodesia was the next to go, was actually what happened in the Belgian Congo, as was then called. And in that whole, in the civil war and everything, and the attempted secession of Katanga, white Belgian Congolese, or whatever they were called, started streaming down in their Peugeot 404s and ended up in a big refugee camp outside Harare, where there were thousands of them. You know, some of them with dead babies in the back of their cars. And also, and the white Rhodesians looked at this and kind of and that, it's no excuse, but I'm saying, but in terms of them freaking out and then behaving in a way that wasn't in their own best interests by any means. That's also a factor that you don't read about because it's not really seen as in the same sphere. Let me just end this bit by saying that for Mugabe, I mean, in that 10-day period where he wanted to have where those elections happened and were out of control, and he suddenly looked tired. We arrived. There were all sorts of deals being brokered. I saw a lot of them. I mean, I knew the ambassadors and things, and they were definitely there, and they were sort of, you could taste them. They were so close. But the strange thing that happened, and it's something that I still don't know what to think about it. I mean, I don't know what conclusion to make, but is that if Mugabe had agreed in 2008, before the second round of the elections, if he just said, you know, what was he then, 80? three, I think. You know, it's enough now. It's fine. And the deals were very good. He was basically, you know, there was one deal where he wouldn't even totally lose power. He would sort of be pushed up to a kind of titular president. They would redraw the constitution. He would still have all the honorifics and all the respect and et cetera, et cetera. And then you'd maybe have, for a while at least, a kind of British-style prime minister underneath him. That his people, his ministers and people who'd all taken ex-white-owned farms could all keep one farm each, that they would be given index-linked pensions, they wouldn't be pauperized, so they would have money, they would have respect, they would have, you know, they would be fine for the rest of their lives, and they would still be, you know, they wouldn't be in any way sort of dishonored. But most importantly, at that point, there was no mention of any kind of revenge, in particular for Matabeleland, which is still the preeminent moral stain on that regime. And because of my understanding of it, and I'm not a lawyer, but because of when the ICC came into being, Matabeleland is initially outside the ICC doesn't actually look at Matabeleland. It happened too long ago. Now, there are ways you can get into it, one thing, but the opposition at the time was saying, we won't bring anybody to court over Matabeleland. That's not what we want to do. We just want to move on. So there was this moment where you know, one could have done that. And instead, they launched this appalling campaign of torture on an industrial scale, which I witnessed and which the fear is all about the circumstances of it and how it happened. And it tells the stories through a lot of the people themselves. And that, from everybody I've spoken to and from my own observation, beyond any doubt, I think, rises to the level of a crime against humanity. It simply does. I mean, if you look at the number of people killed, tortured, raped, the fact that there's a hierarchy. Zimbabwe is many things, but anarchy is not one of them. It's more fascistic than that. It's very things all nothing happens spontaneously. And so weirdly, after that bloody campaign, that 3 or 4 month campaign in 2008. After which the opposition just gave up and wouldn't go into the final runoff. Now there is a problem. I mean, there really is a problem. There's a legal problem, and now, in a weird way, it's stiffened ZANU-PF's resolve that they feel that where do they go now? Because if they give up power, they've got this terrible unresolved violence sitting there now. And it has complicated things, which brings me on to my final thought of this period, which is that that it's my opinion now that in the global political agreement, which the opposition was sort of bullied into mostly by the South Africans to sort of share power, there was a period at which Thabo Mbeki thought that that's what everybody should do in Africa, and the wrong people win in Kenya, it's a draw. The wrong people the wrong people win in Cote d'Ivoire. Thabo Mbeki, what some says, I've got a good idea. Let's call it a draw, and you can share. And I said, well, why are we even bothering to have any elections in Africa at all? If the wrong person wins, it's just a draw. And that was the solution for Zimbabwe as well. And the GPA, the Global Political Agreement, which is drawn up, is a terrible document. If you read it, every time they encounter a problem, they put it off. It's a bit like the debt ceiling here. And it's delayed, so that there are now all of these issues, these very thorny issues, sitting, you know, and minefields within this agreement that are bogging it down, and that mean that in my view, that it won't work. And I think it's my view that ZANU-PF are no closer today to actually contemplating losing power than they were in 2008, and that we've just gone through this 2 or 3 year period now, and we're no closer to a political resolution at all. And I'm sorry to end on a bleak note, but that's what I think. So thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
So if everybody wants to just line up behind the mic.
All right, thank you for a fascinating talk. Interweaving on the China program
here at OSI. And my question for you has to do, I was interested to hear you talk about the book as a memoir, because when I was reading it, it read more like that there was an overt goal of human rights documentation. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, whether you felt like there was tension between those two goals, and whether how overt that was in your own mind in terms of documenting what was happening.
That's a valid point. I mean, I think in the three memoirs that I described, each one of them has got less of me or less of my family in it. I suppose what I'm trying to do, the quick answer is no, I don't think there's that much tension, because what I'm trying to do here is to, is principally, you're right, is to document this and say, this happened. It's not going to go away. We can't just push it under some carpet. The problem in Zimbabwe is repeated lack of accountability. It happens from 1890 onwards. Nobody ever pays for what they do. Regime after regime after regime. Nobody ever ends up in court. Nothing happens with the terrible killings and torture and everything that goes on and on and on. And it's now, my fear is that it's become part of sort of Zimbabwean culture, that people think, well, that's what, you know, that they can perpetuate that kind of violence, perpetrate it, and nothing happens. So yes, I mean, in Zimbabwe, it has to be said, is probably one of the best documented crimes against humanity in Africa. It's done contemporaneously. It's done with eyewitnesses and affidavits and things. I mean, it's not like Sierra Leone or Liberia where we're scrabbling around years afterwards trying to cobble together these cases. And of course, the other great thing it has, great thing in terms of prosecution over those other countries, is that it doesn't have anarchy. You know, it has this very clear, rigid hierarchy that's orders are coming up from the top and going down. You've got ranks and everything else. But what I am trying to do, and what I think is important, is that I it's written in the present tense and it's written in the first person, and very deliberately so. The present tense, for reasons I've already alluded to, because I think that you need to see the messiness and the lack of clarity and the confusion as real, on a real timeline, not in this sort of bogus, sterilized way that, you know, that hindsight enforces. And so, you know, including the rumors and the, you know, which nobody knows of rumors at the time, they believe them until, you know, later on and stuff. And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is I think that readers have a right to know who I am, and I don't want to write in this sort of godlike, you know, third person, you know, with this authorial, bogus objectivity. You know, I mean, I think that there's no such thing as objectivity. I think there is fairness, but I think that, you know, objectivity is something that doesn't really exist in the human breast. And I think what's important is to say, this is who I am. And you factor that into the story that I'm telling, and then you can do it. And let's face it, the other thing, you know, I have a bar to clear when I write about Zimbabwe and Mugabe, which is that I'm a white Zimbabwean, and it's quite an understandable bar, and people need to say, well, let's, you know, let's get over the, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? But let's see, you know, who are you? Declare yourself and whatever. And importantly here, more and more, what I've tried to do is let people speak in their own voices, is just, you know, and unmitigated. But from a writing point of view, there's one other thing, which is that I don't want you to think this book is just, you know, reads like an ICC indictment, you know, which is just sort of catalog of torture, because you wouldn't be able to read that. So what you have to do is leaven it, and you have to just in storytelling terms and whatever, you have to contextualize it, and you have to pull back, and it's about pacing and tone and voice, and just to tell a story that you will want to keep reading, you know. And so that's also helped by inserting yourself a little bit, so that you can react. What I don't want to do, and I don't think it's ever necessary, is, you know, when you read something really terrible, is to sort of nudge the reader's elbow and say, God, isn't that terrible? You know, it's obvious, you know, it's kind of obvious where it is. But you do need sometimes just a break, a pause and whatever. And actually, having said that, this, you know, my purpose was to say, you know, to say, this is my invitation to the ICC, to Morena Ocampo. I'll send it to you with a, you know, ribbon on it. But nevertheless, you know, this stuff is out there, and it's not going to go away. And it's the elephant in the room in the GNU in Zimbabwe. It's the elephant in the room in the negotiations. It's sitting there, and it's not going to go away. I think crutches trump anybody else.
One of the few things I've learned. But my name is Haley Flynn, and I work in the public health program, and thank you so much for your discussion. I admittedly have not read the book, nor have followed Zimbabwe in close politics
available
quite closely.
Available on your way out.
Good to know. but closely since 2008, so I guess I come at it with that lens. But you spoke about how sort of the atrocities that occurred in the wake of the election, and that sort of ZANU-PF isn't really going anywhere. Mugabe obviously is aging, not doing great, so it's unlikely to be an MDC person that would come to be his successor, but who do you see as sort of the people that have emerged from ZANU? Because my understanding was sort of that there was a cadre of people that were sort of a very strong group of people, but they had their own sort of interconnected animosities toward one another, so that that would be quite a challenging succession. So also, what does that pose for chaos sort of in the wake of Mugabe? So thank you.
A small question. No, I mean, a completely valid one. It's Mugabe's 87. I mean, he has prostate issues and one thing and another. I have to say, he's about the healthiest 87-year-old I've ever seen in my life. I mean, he's astonishingly healthy. But I don't think he's in this, at the moment. I worry that the State Department's policy is to Mugabe wait till Mugabe dies, and that's not good enough. I mean, because I think what's more likely to happen is that he's going to lose his full functioning. You know, he won't be able to kind of actually be the president. But I think he's already a massive delegator. He always has been. You know, he's ZANU-PF's icon. He's the only president the country's ever had. So, you know, that's why one of the reasons they're desperate for an early election while he's still there, and they're still talking even now about an election later, 2012. They're talking about, you know, even though it's manifestly impossible in terms of the electoral roll is a disaster, and half of these reforms that are supposed to be sine qua non, you know, the conditions before which these, you know, the elections can't happen, haven't been carried out. I think ZANU-PF faces, and it's important to realize that, you know, I think in analytical terms, there must be something about humans which is instinctively binary. I know we've got two arms and two legs and two eyes and two hemispheres to our brain or something, and everything we want to do is binary. So you look at something like Zimbabwe and you immediately want to say there's the opposition and there's ZANU-PF and they're in this battle. But actually, you know, while this is going on, ZANU has also got its own issues. It's got its own pain and its own things that really, you know, are nothing to do with the opposition as such. And one of the problems is the leadership succession, which they would have a problem over anyway, and they have multiple issues here. I mean, I was thinking the other day, you know, if you were, you imagine the president's office in Zimbabwe phoning somebody like McKinsey's and saying, "Hi, you know, someone saying, I have a client, and he's a remain nameless, a president of an African state who has succession problems. You know, what would you advise him to do?" And sitting doing it as a sort of management consultant thing, and they say, "Well, the first thing you would do, you are the icon. You've been there. You're associated with the whole country. You're the only president. You should, as soon as possible, get hold of whoever it is you want and grab this person and put them there and say, this is my person and I'm imbuing him with all of my authority, and what he says is, you know, not like Putin and Medvedev. I mean, a real situation. Not until I come back from the dead. No, but you know, in real terms, and that this person would then grow in stature, and give him lots of publicity in all the state media and whatever, until such time as slowly as Mugabe sort of, you know, lessened. This guy would, whoever it was, would, you know. And Mugabe absolutely has done the opposite to that. He will not do that. As soon as any candidate sort of nudges above the others, he deliberately destabilizes that person, does something to edge him out and whatever. Now, part of that could just be the hubris that is in, you know, part of being a dictator, that you don't want to contemplate your own mortality and somebody succeeding and whatever. And there may be an element of that. But ZANU-PF also has a real problem, which is that ZANU, you know, people talk about the Shona, this and the Shona, that. But ZANU-PF has two, you know, has various factions within it. I mean, not least of which, you know, a Karanga and a Zazuru faction, who have their own leaders, and the Karangas feel that it's their turn. And there are lots of other ones that I won't go into. But, and that for Mugabe to make a choice, any choice, is to create losers within the party. So if you choose this person, now you've created a dissatisfied constituency out of this person, this person, this person, and their followers. And you risk them going, you know, they have other options now. They might move across the MDC. They might set up on their own. They might do, you know, they. So that's also been an issue, is how you manage that. And I think that's, you know, for this foreseeable election, which is, they want Mugabe's kind of their unity candidate. And I think once, if they get through that, then they'll have to deal with the leadership issue at that point. Yes.
Hi, Martin. My name is Wale Ajibade. I am the executive director of African Views Organization. I first came across your work on the Washington Post, I think around March. I thought that was an excellent article, and I've been looking forward to the opportunity of actually talking to you. So I'm really delighted that you're here today. The reason is we are putting together the first African Cultural Exchange Institute in Gweru. I've never been to Zimbabwe, and this is a strategy to try to reinstate all the values that were there before. This is being built on 25 acres of land within 22,000 acres of arable land, so it's going to include sustainable agriculture, and it's going to revive the more valuable or value-based African education system, such as the African diaspora as well as the European African education system that were there in Zimbabwe before. All that being said, the reason of my question is, while we have this process ongoing, what kind of challenges are we going to be facing in Zimbabwe? Because we're afraid that it might take some political turns, and if they go, so what?
You could say that. I mean, you know, it's an interesting question, both in your particular example, in the micro example, but also, you know, on a macro field. And in fact, there was somebody in the MDC, a guy called Eddie Cross, actually just wrote an essay last week about, you know, when people say, should we be investing in Zimbabwe? You know, and I want to say, no, run for the door. No, I mean, not yet. There's been no political resolution. There has been no political resolution. So at some point in the next 2 or 3 years, there's going to be, you know, I mean, hopefully, maybe it'll end well, maybe it won't, maybe it'll go to war, maybe it'll, you know, but the fundamental problem is that there still has been no political resolution. Having said that, we're in this bizarre parallel universe where the opposition sits in an inclusive government. I mean, it's neither really inclusive or governing, I think, but with, you know, while they glower at each other, you know, from their various ministerial buildings, they've divvied up the ministries. Some, you know, some are in the soft ministries or MDC, and the hard ministries stay with ZANU-PF, and they pretend they're governing together when in fact it's kind of, you know, they're in their castles, you know, with their crossbows poking out of their crenellations. It's bizarre. My advice to people who want to help at the moment, while we're, you know, because you say, well, what are you supposed to do? Just sit in your hands and wait for what, 2 years, 5 years? How much longer is this going to go on? I mean, we never thought it would go on for 10 years. We're now in the 11th year of this, you know, ridiculous thing. And in that time, the Zimbabwean economy has been destroyed. I mean, it's just spiraled, you know, beyond anyone's imagination of how bad it could get. Now, the economy is slightly better, but because of only one thing, which is that they jettisoned the Zimbabwe dollar and replaced it with the American dollar. And so there's no, you know, hyperinflation had got so bad by the end, by 2009, that the currency was halving in value every 24 hours, effectively. I mean, it was, you know, and you couldn't run anything, and things were at least stabilized to that extent, but nobody's investing at all, and the legal, you know, right down to legal title is a problem. So I don't know what the land is that, you know, this 22,000 acres, who have you bought it from? Have you been given it? Who was the previous owner? Have you got the title deeds? Are you, Zimbabwe's basically phased out freehold ownership. It was one of the few countries in Africa that still had freehold title for land. South Africa is another one, Namibia. But the law is in complete disarray at the moment. And sometimes, with these farm takeovers, what you look at them, for example, some farms are on their seventh or eighth owner now. So that that there's a white farmer who's chucked out, and people come in and squat on the land. Then they get thrown out because army major comes, and then he gets kicked out by a Supreme Court judge, and he gets kicked out by a government minister. Nobody has real title anymore, and so there's that's now happening with the so-called indigenization legislation that's coming through. A similar thing will now happen in mines and in businesses over a certain size, that it leaves this sort of legal frisson that nobody quite knows. And the thing is, you're fine until you're not fine. So as long as you're friendly with everybody and they like you, but the minute that you do something that someone doesn't like, they say, you know what, this isn't yours anymore. Or you know what, and when they take it, they don't just take the land, they take what you've built on it. You've invested this building, and no, then someone will, and often it happens out of jealousy. You don't even annoy people. They see this nice building going up, and someone says, boy, that's a nice building, in Gweru, we haven't seen many buildings going up. And then someone gets jealous, and then you find that, that person's connected. So that's the problem at the moment. Having said that there isn't anarchy, and there is this sort of, you're living in a ZANU-PF fiefdom, in a sense. And so any investment is ultimately, insecure. It's at the ruling party's pleasure that it continues or doesn't continue. I do think, though, that there have been, and I don't want to overlook this, huge strides in rehabilitating Zimbabwe, in particular in health and education, which had just collapsed completely. I mean, absolutely completely. And those two ministries happen to have opposition ministers running them, and they've set up ways to bring in money directly that doesn't have to go through Gideon Gono's Reserve Bank and one thing or another. And and I think that, David Coulthard is at education has done a good job, but I mean, is still really struggling. I mean, very, really struggling, and has, there are all sorts of weird games going on. Mugabe suddenly announced that he would double all civil servants' salaries without saying where the money would come from necessarily, and it was just, so these games continue. So you understand that you're going into a potentially very volatile environment, and as long as you realize that, then you're on your own. Yes.
Professor, thank you so much for coming. My name is Alexander. I'm from Rio de Janeiro. I'm a physician and a public health master from NYU. And I've been noticing and studying lately a lot about cultural shifts. And I noticed that social institutions, social practices only change after the cultural basis has changed. And regarding that, the role of intellectuals, writers, artists is fundamental in questioning the assumptions of society and moving forward. So my question is, what are you doing to put the word of your book and out there in Zimbabwe, in a grassroots level, because that's where change ultimately comes from? Thank you.
Thanks. I mean, that's true, I think. I mean, and I would love to think that my book will be will change everything. Unfortunately, the realities on the ground in Zimbabwe are that very few people can afford books at all. In fact, very few people proportionally can afford newspapers. And the key, I mean, it's one of the many things that is the logjam to the next stage in having free and fair elections in Zimbabwe. The key is that everybody has free and fair access to the media overall. The game changer in rural Africa in elections and everything else is radio still. I mean, FM radio is the kind of Facebook of rural Africa. It's how they talk to each other. It's how, that's, and people have cell phones and things, but FM radio, it's cheap, and where it's ubiquitous, it changes the landscape completely. There's a wonderful story that's only partly apocryphal, I think. The British journalists have this saying, too good to check, when your story is working out well. You don't want to ruin it. But that in Ghana, when Rawlings was handing over, And I think it was the EU, I can't remember. It was various people were moving into, because suddenly the media landscape opened up and they were allowed to, you know, so they were setting up these FM stations. And some of them, you know, literally you put up a little beacon and you've got this little town or this little area. The radios are cheap. It's almost like, you know, Hyde Park Corner or something, you know, sitting in the market and chatting. And that process was still going on when they had the first elections. And in every area where they had got FM radio up and running, people felt much less constrained and voted for the opposition parties. And where they hadn't got it running, they didn't. And it was that clear, you know, that's... So, and in Zimbabwe, there's still today only one broadcaster, the state broadcaster. The opposition or so-called independent radio stations that come in are all shortwave and they come in from outside the country. And when Mugabe's militia and even when the military go through, and they, you know, they're going through villages and things, wherever they see a shortwave radio, which, by the way, is much more expensive as well, they stomp on it with their boots and break it. At one point, the American embassy brought in, you know, thousands of shortwave radios for general distribution, and Mugabe sent soldiers out, and they just destroyed them. And wherever they find a shortwave radio, they take that as a prima facie indication that you support the opposition, and that, you know, depending on the political temperature and the cycle where we are in an election cycle, they'll burn your house and whatever if they find a shortwave radio. So that's really the big thing. As a little caveat to that, there are what you're finding actually, which is quite remarkable, but I suppose predictable in some ways, is that there's a growing black Zimbabwean diaspora now. It's huge. I mean, by some accounts, there are a quarter of all black Zimbabweans, maybe even more, are outside the country and have been outside for, you know, really considerable period of time and have brought their children up. And so what you're getting now, you're beginning to get in greater volume, are short stories and books being written by black Zimbabweans in the diaspora about Zimbabwe. And it's, I mean, one of them just won the Kane Prize, actually, Violet Bulawayo, just won the Kane Prize. So you're getting a cultural shift there as well, which is kind of remarkable.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Rajan Parekh. First, thank you for a really fascinating, multifaceted story. And kind of as a follow-up to the previous question, given the increasing use of 3G and 4G internet and mobile phone in Africa and Kenya and Uganda, they're using phones in ways we haven't even dreamed of, and the undersea cables going to Africa, so internet access improving, given the obstacles to even shortwave radio, what do you see the scope for potentially using for social change other forms of media, as well as the scope for using film? Because there are a lot of, for example, in Congo, there were a lot of new indigenous African filmmakers starting to do something interesting. And would you be interested, or have you thought about perhaps making some sort of film version of your book or other stories to help change?
Good points all. There are these, I'm sure most of you know, there are these undersea cables coming into Africa. And in fact, Zimbabwe they've just built a fiber optic cable coming up to Harare. You know, I think it's come from the Mozambique side. So if you're in the right place in Harare, you can get faster internet access than I can get in Upper Manhattan. But having said that, and cell phones are extraordinary in Africa, and I think there's this phenomenon of leapfrog technology that in certain places where you see that in a sense. You saw that in America, where we were stuck with NTSC TV for years, which when you went to Europe and got the PAL, you could see it was like watching high def to standard, and that was for years and years because America got TV first. So it's the same. Lots of parts of Africa where they didn't even have telephone lines as such have just gone straight to cell phones. And Zimbabwe, their Econet and various other companies have invested hugely in putting cell phones up. And opposition do use them, for example, to warn people that of security situations, or to tell people that there are meetings, or that they use text all the time. But the but the, they have a law in Zimbabwe now where they can just go to the service providers and basically, you know, and they can access everything anytime they want. And right now they're also going after Tendai Biti, the Minister of Finance, for all of his cell phone records because they're trying to embarrass him over something and they're trying to destabilize him and keep him completely sort of, you know, and it's a ridiculous situation that just, you know, once again shows how this whole thing is just a charade, which I sort of wish they'd pull the plug on and just let us get onto the next stage, whatever that might be. So, yes, its potential is huge, but with the proviso that at the moment the security forces, the CIO and whatever, have complete access to anything they like. So you take your life in your hands whenever you send a message or send an email or whatever. They can and will intercept you if that's what they want. And that's the big break, the thing that slows it down in Zimbabwe. I mean, you know, given that, you know, recently you'll see there this group of people who were arrested for taping CNN's coverage of you know, Tahrir Square and the Tunisian, you know, the Arab Spring, sort of first 2 or 3 weeks of it, and were just re-showing it in their home to people who were interested, and they were all arrested and charged with high treason, and they've been spent the last, you know, months in jail and whatever. So that's the kind of reality of the environment that we're operating in there.
Hi, my name's Dean Sharp, and I'm also a fellow journalist, but I was based mainly in the Middle East. And I just really wanted to ask about, I mean, obviously you're explaining to an international audience what's going on in Zimbabwe, really, and obviously having to explain what is going on, and often it's done through individuals like Mugabe is almost Zimbabwe. And for the Middle East, obviously with my experience, I find that can be really quite problematic, you know, trying to explain Egypt as Mubarak, or Libya as Gaddafi, or in particular Syria as Assad. I mean, you can't get the complexities of what's going on, and as you were saying earlier in your talk, how you know, we're constantly simplifying, not just into good and evil, but explaining, you know, these flat nation states now just as individuals. You know, how do you engage with that?
It's a good point. And I mean, to be fair, this book, notwithstanding its subtitle, has really got about one chapter that's specifically about Mugabe himself. And in fact, you know, one of the points that I've made there, and I think you would find that, you would probably have seen that in the Middle East, is that dictators or authoritarian figures have this bizarrely schizophrenic ability to be both ubiquitous and remote at the same time. They're sort of everywhere, their photos and this and that, but actually you can never really sort of get who are they, where they aren't, they're there but they're not there. They're sort of, you know, it's bizarre in that sense. It's a sort of feeling, almost the way that those authoritarian regimes invoke the name of somebody, that, you know, that everything's being done in the name of something. So mostly what I mean, I've tried to tell a story through lots of different people, many of whom aren't important per se. They're not ministers and sort of, you know, they're not public names. They're just, you know, they're folk around. So that's how I've tried to get around it there, by giving one, you know, I imagine that it's like, you know, a dark room and you shine a whole lot of little flashlights. And if you have enough little beams, you start to see the shape of what's there. But no one beam tells the whole story. It doesn't a light on something and that's it. It isn't. I mean, you know, it really isn't. And it's a real problem. I mean, writing for a non-expert audience is always a problem. But there again, writing for an audience who really knows a hell of a lot can be a different problem, insofar as they'll have very fixed views and they'll be coming from a particular angle often because they know, precisely because they know so much. And I've been humbled, actually, sometimes, you know, because one can tend to be arrogant, you know, after, if you know and writing about something again and again and again, you can slip into these grooves where you just think you know, that this is, and just occasionally someone who really doesn't have that much background or something can come in with a fresh pair of eyes and see something and make some remark, and you look, and you're taken aback and you think, wow, there this thing is, and it's been in hiding in plain sight, and I hadn't actually noticed it, or I'd grown so used to it that I didn't, you know, I've stopped seeing this reality or that reality. But you're right. I mean, you've used one phrase though there that I would probably have to
correct in the case of Africa, which is that we don't have very many nation states in Africa. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that nations and states don't overlap. That we're left with these bizarre colonial constructs that are often the cause of so much tension within Africa, within the countries themselves, and even between the countries, because they cut clear across ethnic and economic and geographical and every other line rational line you can possibly think around which you would organize a nation state. And that's been a problem with Zimbabwe as well as a lot of other African countries. Thank you. If anybody wants me to sign books, I think there are books over there, which I'm happy to do on the way out. Thank you.
Thank you.